Well, yeah, that's fine.
Mm. You weren't here when they actually moved.
No. My sister was there.
Yeah. When was the first time you sort of came back and they'd all gone?
I heard, I was at Inverary, and as soon as the invasion had taken place, we knew, you know, it became knowledge, you know, that they had started to invade. Well, the people who were trained up there, funny enough, one of my best pals now was one of, I told you, was the third tank off a landing barge when they had the Shermans and they were putting skirts on them, flotation skirts. And the first two of his group, they were on these landing barges training at Inverary and on Loch Fyne, and I had to go along with an ambulance and collect the bodies, bring them back to, we had a sort of morgue area near the castle, you know, in Inverary. And I didn't know till many years later that Ron Williams was on the third tank, but the first one went off, you know, slowly like that, sort of to get in the water. No one had ever done this, you see, and it went straight under because Tommy got halfway and their nose dropped and it filled before it could get level, because this skirt was only enough, this flotation skirt, or like a balloon, or tubes of plastic, I suppose, like our rubber boats today, the same kind of thing. But so that was the first one in. The second one thought, well, it's a mistake here, going creeping out. So he went off fast. And of course, he went off fast and went whoosh into the water. The waves went up like that, and they came in, and under that went. Ron Williams said, well, I was the driver of the third one, and I thought, well, I don't want to go down. And so, you know, this is after a little time, so he opted to say for about 5 or 6 miles an hour, or, you know, enough inertia to just get him out from dipping in, but at the same time, not enough to make too much wash, and it worked. I don't know what he said, whatever the speed was, or so many revolutions, you know. So you can imagine, that's with Sherman. You can imagine, and so after that, it became the norm then to get off at a certain speed.
That was an exercise, was it?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was the training exercise. Remember, when they went across the other side, despite the caissons or the monoliths, they took over all the rest of it, but the tanks went in landing craft, which could only get in so far, and if the tanks had come off there, they would have gone, might have been waterlogged, because they were nearly all petrol engines in those days, you know. And although they were fairly well sealed, but not the sort of thing to run, well, their own weight alone was sufficient to be quite a problem, so they developed this skirt around, this, or flotation tube, it is joined to the hull. And so that was one of the ways of getting tanks ashore. If you went into Stansford Beach, a steep rising beach, you could rub your landing craft straight to it. But to fool the Germans, they went to a shallow beach. Obviously, the whole operation was to, the Germans, or the occupying forces, thought, well, they'll never land here, they can't get near. Or if they'd have gone to certain areas, if they'd gone to, say, north of Dunkirk, for instance, they couldn't have landed there because it's a long, shallow area. See, it's a bit like, you know, one of these long, sandy beaches, equally where they went here. But you see, so the whole thing must have been designed to fool the enemy.
This exercise, you said you as an ambulance crew had to stand by. Were some people killed on that those exercises then?
Where? In Inverary?
In Inverary, yeah.
Oh, well, no, I didn't have to stand by. We ran a hospital, but it wasn't anticipated we were going to lose people. But once the two tanks, but Navy people got the people out of the tanks, they were recovered, the tanks and the bodies. But then there was somebody to dispose of the bodies. We ran a hospital in Inverary for the whole of the forces there, the forces being trained. We ran a hospital, a hutted hospital, as well as in the castle itself, we had our operating theatre. But, you know, we had all sorts of people, doctors, everyone there. But obviously there were, I mean, when you get several thousand troops, I mean, there were all sorts of troops, not just British troops, Canadian, American, whatnot. You understand that illnesses, broken legs, accidents, so you have to have everywhere you go in a war or in civilian life, you've got to have a medical team for some reason or other. So that's why we were there as a medical team or a medical unit, you know, to cover any eventualities that might occur there.
So you had to they recovered those bodies?
Those bodies, yeah, we just recovered them by ambulance. Well, we had ambulance drivers who were all women in those days, or nearly all, in this country. Yeah, not all, but nearly all. And, you know, it's just that you opted, you always if you wanted to run out, like we used to go to Glasgow sometimes, you see. So I opted to go. I'd always be on call if they wanted somebody to go, because a lot of people didn't want to go. They wanted to stay where they are. Well, I was a chap, I wanted to see something of the world as well as, you know, being a medic, you didn't want to restrict yourself to be just doing, I'm only going to do this. Now, wherever we were, I always opted to get something out of life. And but that was one of the jobs, was to pick up these bodies, you know.
When D-Day occurred,
yeah.
Everything left from here.
Yeah.
I know you weren't here then.
No, quite.
Did you come back?
I came home on leave. Well, yeah, let me see. Oh, I have to think this out when it occurred. I remember all this went on long after this. I was discharged from Inverary, actually, oddly enough. But that was in, must have been in the Mark. I'd have to look in the Mark. I can't think about that. The next year, it must have been. Yeah, God, yeah. Yeah, I have to think of it. Yeah, it was, yeah. But I stayed there.
But what did this area look like when you came back?
When I came back, if you say leave, apart from the gun emplacement, we had gun emplacements along here, which then were called down once the thing was off. There weren't so many raids, obviously, because the whole pattern of the war changed, and the German forces had gone into Russia as well, hadn't they? They had to spread their load a bit too much, obviously. It was pretty obvious that, you know, to, well, the faction of being through Egypt and into Greece and Italy. You imagine they must have really, although they utilized other nationals, but they must have had quite a problem, mustn't they?
But did this area, was it still littered with
oh, rubbish? Yes, like all the residue, there still is up the river. They had landing barges here which fired the rocket guns, you know. They use a battery, they fire projectiles. I remember on leave them firing them at these radio-controlled aircraft they had over, and they fired at them to bring them down. And some of the remnants are still up the river there, just little bits of rust shale now. But, well, even I ran into one of my rubber boats one day and put a hole in it by touching one of these, where the metal had sort of eaten away and had sharp edges, you know. But there's still remnants up there now in the mud of the planes, you know, the model, they were models actually, or controlled models that they fired at. And yeah, all sorts of equipment still, like I told you, the pipes are still in the mud up here towards Inchmere, only about half a mile up here, past Leaf House. It's not as far, where the road forks to Exbury, you know it forks, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
About a quarter, half mile long here.
Yeah.
But if you went down that lane there, there's a lane there, Gypsy Lane, it's got a bar across, and they shouldn't have a bar there. It's a public right of way, that is. But there it is. There's an installation there. Oil from one of the cables goes across the island there, one of the submarine cables. But just the same, that area, if you walk down there, it's only a matter of 200 yards, not that, 150 yards. You look, as soon as you look there, out on the mud there, from there, going that way for several hundred yards, is where all that imitation submarine pens were. I mean, a lot of people wouldn't know about that because it was taken down after the landings. It was all, I mean, they took away the canvas and stuff, but the pipe work and still a lot of the tubular scaffolding, a lot of it was taken away. But the two people who did it, or mainly with the services, but they were two civilians, were London boys. Well, we didn't have electricity here there. It was quite incredible. These boys were lovely lads, a couple of lovely lads. But one of them smoked a pipe, and we had oil lamps, you know, just with the two wicks going up, you know, had to trim the wick and paraffin lamps and candles, that's all you had. But these lads, it was great how they, one of them, my mother gave him one of the lamps to take home to London for lighting his pipe on. He used to light his pipe over the glass chimney of the lamp. It was really funny to see this. But to them, you know, brought up with electricity, you see, they thought this was incredible. But I can remember my mother giving him one of these old brass lamps. I've still got one in the cupboard there.
When the troops all moved out and all these caissons had gone,
yeah.
Were you then able to walk along the beach and look at all the places where they had been?
Well, yes, because they were disbanded immediately. You know what I mean? They were left. But when you say could you walk there, some of them were still under military control. You couldn't walk along a beach, but if you had a boat, you would go along there. But basically, once they were finished, you know, they didn't want any more caissons, did they? The program was to build so many for the job, and that was it, finished. And the whole thing, There were no more workmen there. Well, some of the old huts and things remained there for quite a while. Well, after the war, I looked after a military camp here in the trees down there, which was the where they had these three guns. They were called Twin Sixes, the naval twin. They were single guns from the Twin Six configuration of naval ships, 6-inch guns, and they had a retinue of service people there. But after the war, it was used for summer camps for the national servicemen and whatnot. And I looked after it for 7 years. Lived in a hut there. It was great, really. Lovely life there. We had summer camps with hundreds of, you know, young people, soldiers, you know, doing their military training, with professional soldiers as well. But the winters were always lovely, about 5 or 6 months, with great fun, just the whole area to ourselves, to do what we like, shooting and pheasants and rabbits and all sorts of things. Great. But the area was still closed to the public on the beach, yeah. On the beach from there, the point down there round, yeah. Still closed for quite a while. And I had notices that with the broad arrows on, but danger mines also, just to stop people coming round and being a nuisance. Because, you know, the people once thought, oh, Christ, we're going, there must be something. There were a lot of huts there, a lot of equipment, which I had to keep my eye on, you know, through the winter months. In the summer, we had plenty of military personnel, but in the winters, they were just me, my family, and so it was a great, you know, I had 7 great years, really a lot of fun, a lot of things, yeah.
So presumably that pipeline was still there, wasn't it? The pipeline was going across to France.
Well, yeah, there were 14 pipeline. Of them, yeah. Well, what happened after the war, they weren't worried about the steel pipes, but remember these pipes were made of tin and lead, 80% tin, which had always been a very valuable commodity, and they were recovered, but in recovering those here, they had a traction engine or two on the beach, you know. The kind of thing that my forebears brought down from Northumbria, with a huge turntable underneath, you know, driven by steam. And they winched these in. They cut them in the middle. They did it on the other side, or further over in the middle. They cut them. They winched them in. But the chap in charge of this was a naval PO, and he took some lads on leave, coming back through the trees here. He'd had a few of these. They'd had their rummage and whatnot, and he... My brother found his body and he came back to me. I was in that camp then, and I wasn't married then, but I was just moving in there, going to take over as caretaker. But he was killed, this lad, and so the whole operation was disbanded, and some of that pipeline is still out there.
Well, how was he killed?
When he ran out of road and through the trees in a 30-hundredweight truck and hit a tree and sort of fell out as the vehicle went sideways into a tree, and practically just, my brother called me, my twin brother, and it practically tore him in half, you know, he was dead, you know. Nothing we could do. I came straight back and rang the police and the Navy, and they came and took him away, whatnot. And the whole thing was called off then.
Because well, he was the only expert who...
Well, he was in charge of it, yeah, that's right. So there were only 2 or 3 of them there doing it, but they were recovering this tin. Remember the tin and lead? Well, the tin itself was the most valuable of the commodities. Still a very extremely expensive metal, even today, isn't it? But then it was used for, apart from war things, remember that tin doesn't oxidise easily, so it's used for, not easily, so it's used for, it's quite a strong material as well, but with the lead in it, made it pliable. They could bend these tubes around these huge drums, you see. Remembering it's hollow and they had to pump fuel through it, but...
Where was this camp that you were talking about?
In the trees there, what's called the Country Park down there.
Where the Country Park is now?
Yeah, the one on the top, not the bottom one. Yeah, no, that's up in there. Yeah, amongst those trees there were 21 huts, all 36 footers, and there were further down three gun emplacements, ammunition bays, and whatnot, the generating plant, which I used to run. But I used to save up the diesel in the summer so that I had plenty for the winter. I had it all well organised, yeah, very well organised. 110 volts of it, yeah, but it was great. I mean, I could do what I liked with it, but it was, but the whole thing, it was all locked. No one else was allowed. It was just myself, my family, and the dog. I had a good dog. He'd tell me if anyone was half a mile away. Great, great dog, yeah. But,
So was that beach closed still all the way through to Kemmerton?
Yeah, not the bottom. You know where the car park is at the bottom there? Yeah. Well, when you go round there's an area, as you come to the end of that beach, from there east, that was closed, yep.
Right through the car shop?
Yeah, right through the car shop. Well, nearly the car shop, yeah. Yeah. Right. Until, well, one section of it was only to where the where there was a pier down there and the staging, where they did the refueling and everything for the barges and the tugs and everything. There was a pier around there, a proper pier, big, you know, wooden piles in it, and bridge work over it, tubular pipe work, out to where the barges and stuff came on. And the troops, a lot of troops boarded from there. Although the caissons went there, so did a lot of troops went from there. And they had a fuel lines from thing came and connected there, not for going overseas, just for the vessels, you know, that wanted fuel and water. And the two monoliths are still, not monoliths, what do we call them? They're wooden structures. They're still in the water down there now. That's the last relics left around that corner. But in the water, when the tide's out or below that, there's masses of rusted tubular scaffolding. It's nearly all gone now, rusted away. And there's still some big heavy chain in the beach where they, I told you, pulled these caissons off. And quite a few of these cannonballs.
When they were using those caissons, pulling them on the pulley system?
Yeah.
How was that driven? Was that driven by a steam engine or an electric engine?
Well, I would have thought they just used vehicles with a winch on the front, any military vehicle, or just a winch on the beach. You'd only need a winch. Once they were on the ball bearings, you can push a hell of a lot of weight.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they got them and they just tipped over the edge, did it at high tide and just floated them in the water. They had to be gentle about that. Obviously, they were pulling one way, but they were obviously didn't let them run away with themselves because you could fracture them and damage them. So they had to be very careful how they did it. But I've worked on construction, I know what it's about. You have to be, when you deal with something that could be, I don't know how many tons, maybe 30 or 40 tons, maybe more, these guys were more than that, because they were reinforced concrete, still reinforcing in them. Mm. And you have to be careful rather than damaging them. Yeah. Quite a business. It was a very well organized business, the whole thing. Must have been very well planned. Right the way through. The real reason was to fool the enemy. Subterfuge.
Seemed to work.
But it did, didn't it? Yeah, really. It's a pretty good operation. But the general public, I mean, wasn't allowed here during that time of building out. But even if they were, even me on leave, unless I'd been told, I wouldn't have known they were building them down there or anywhere. But it's just that having relatives and friends in the area, you know knew what was going on.
But did people here make friends with the troops?
My people did. The troops used to give them rations, especially when the Yanks were down here. My people were having turkey and Christ knows what. They would give them, yeah. They would come up for a yarn, you know. But it's only just walk up over the field. Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, it's always seemed to have plenty of everything.
Oh, they did, yeah. Booze, you name it, they had it. But prior, for the few days, or whatever it could have been, a few weeks before, they didn't integrate much, you know, because the whole thing was a secret, and they were obviously, you know. Well, those that worked around, the liaison people who dealt with local authorities, obviously they did keep their contacts, but there wasn't a lot of great contact as such, not in the sense they didn't. They went to our local club in the village of Exbury, yeah, all sorts of services went there. It was a great, great place. Come home on leave, it was full of people and dances and fun. You know, we all had a lot of fun on leave, yeah. Great time. But the place, the New Forest, back in the forest further, Brockenhurst, around there, Lyndhurst, all those areas, from there back this way, full of troops and tanks and things, obviously well concealed. You know, it's an ideal area,
wasn't it? All those trees and a very good beaching place.
Well, all these trees, if you notice coming through these trees down this road or certain areas, there's lay-bys. A lot of the trees are gone now. But where the trees were growing there, you wouldn't see a tank in every one of these lay-bys. Could have had three or four tanks, you see, these long lay-bys. But they were obscured just for the trees and tall hedges. No hedges were cut during the war. And all you had to do was have bits of camouflage netting. You would have never seen them. When I came home, it was always by bicycle, you know, you came down the road by bike, unless I came by this chap, Edward, or, you know, there was a local carrier from Exbury, old Rowley Hart and the same. But basically, my people would leave a bike up at my brother or somebody to tow another bike up to the Langley pub there. You'd let them know when you were coming, and you'd have a bicycle there, whatever time you arrived there. If you could get there, you had a bike to get home. But everywhere there was military equipment, but it was all well concealed. But these roads were done for the tanks, because remembering the tanks had to get here on what was then rather remote or old-fashioned gravel roads. They weren't even macadam roads, but they built them in concrete because they would have, you know, fallen through all sorts of things.
You can still see the concrete joined up.
Well, yes, that's right. Well, that was all done prior to the invasion process, yeah. The same people who did that, but the same, some of them were the people who worked on the monoliths, funnily enough.
Well, all
the same crews. It was all concrete, you see, yeah.
They were Irish, weren't they?
No, some of them were, quite a few of them were local people, and then they shipped people in from Southampton and areas. They had buses bringing people, you know. They had, you know, regular people working, nearly all older people, you know, working on these things.
So the young would have been in the forces anyway, I suppose.
Oh, most young people were, unless you had a deferred occupation. Now, Johnny, you know, my brother-in-law was a shipbuilder, shipwright. So he was working in the British Power Boat, making motor torpedo boats, so he would have obviously had a deferred occupation.
Was this beach mined at all during the war? I mean,
no. Supposedly, it ran Stone Point area, ran there, but it wasn't. I mean, it had, I put a notice up, mines, danger mine. No, the only mined beaches were those, Deal Beach, when I was down there during the war. That's, you know, east of, northeast of Dover. Any of the beaches which would appear to be an appropriate landing area for the German and occupying forces in Europe, those areas were mined. But basically,